Welcome to the Baptist Joint Committee podcast. In this episode, professor and author Michael Meyerson discusses religious support for the separation of church and state. He delivered this presentation at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, for the 2014 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State.
Thank you all for having me, Dr. Bellinger. Fred Walker, thank you all. I want to talk a little about sort of the theory behind the lecture. The theory behind the lecture is that we have to, when we talk about religion and government, when we try to figure out the right answer, have to listen to both sides, if not all sides. And so when I started the book, the motivation for the book was this feeling that people were only getting pieces of history. Sometimes it's called cherry picking. You looked at history, you found a quote. Go online, and you'll see these random quotes from Madison on left or right, pro or this or pro or con. And it seemed to me that something as important, as fundamental as the relationship between religion and government needed to be approached with a much more open view. And so I found several heroes. I don't know about you guys. I'm old and I'm still looking for heroes. And occasionally I find them. And one of them actually is George Washington, who turns out to be sort of as neat as we were told in fourth grade, but he really is. The other surprising hero to my book is John Leland. We'll talk about him a lot today, Baptist minister of the late 1700s into the early 1800s. But I found a quote of his that motivated me throughout my book. He wrote, "Truth is to history as the soul is to the body." And I found that to be so sophisticated and so deep that if you do history, if you're looking at the past, but you're not looking for truth, then it's like a dead body. There's nothing there. There's nothing meaningful, nothing transcendent, nothing permanent. So what I decided to try to do was to be as open as I could be and find as much as I could find out. And in terms of the particular topic for today's lecture, the false divide, one of the things I discovered that the cherry pickers have done is they have forced people into camps. Either you are religious and therefore you believe this, or you believe that, which means you must not be religious. And I found that history didn't go that way. So let me give you a little running start about, and I'm going to go into sort of the framing of the Constitution and the beginning of the Republic, and sort of how we created America's belief and theory, America's unique gift to the world, one of the unique gifts, a true theory of freedom of religion, and the role that religious people played in creating it. Most people know about Thomas Jefferson, James Madison. They are the heroes, in a sense, of part of the story. And I found that the religious people who motivated them, who educated them, who lobbied for them, who won with them, are just ignored by both left and right. So let's talk about sort of how religion and government were created in the New World, and how something better, something permanent, something truly American was created. You all know the colonies started with a lot of religious context. And if you look at colonies like Virginia and Massachusetts, which are sort of like the largest colonies, and they were both from different sort of religious viewpoints, they both claimed that they were being founded, quote, for the purpose of propagating the Christian religion. But one of the things history books may not tell you is when they said Christian, they meant themselves. So Virginia said, we believe in the Christian religion, which means everyone will follow the Church of England. Massachusetts said, it's all about Christianity, but anyone suspected of believing in, quote, the superstition of the Church of Rome will be banished. So you start out with these people claiming to represent this broad religion, but all they were focusing on, all they believed that matters, was their own religion, was their own doctrine. And so you had these, from England, you had the Church of England. Then in Massachusetts, you had the Puritans, who evolved into the Congregationalists. And their view of other religions ranged from hostility to hostility. There really was nothing else. They didn't like anyone else. And when the Baptists started sort of showing up, both Virginia and Massachusetts just viewed them with horror. So in 1644, Massachusetts says that basically Baptists who openly preach or believe will be sentenced to banishment. And when you disobey that, you have three prisoners who were, quote unquote, well whipped. Each prisoner had 30 strokes, and blood flowed in little streams down through their clothing. This is a violent place. Not the only Baptists aren't the only ones being assaulted. Quakers who were driving people crazy in Massachusetts. If you were banished and came back, the heretical opinions of Quakers would be met with death. So you have this sense of fear, of hatred, of any religion that threatened the dominant religion. And there was this feeling that, in the words of one of the Puritans, if you are willing to tolerate other religions, you must either doubt your own or not be sincere believers. If you truly believe that only one way, then how can you allow others to say something else? And that was, if you will, the colonial experience, certainly the beginning in the 1600s. Around the 1730s or so, I'm assuming you all studied the Great Awakening, which was, in a very strange sense, the first American feeling. This is before the Revolution. But it was the sense that the colonies weren't going to be the limit. You wouldn't have a Massachusetts view of religion. You wouldn't have a Virginian view. The ministers would go up and down past colonial lines, getting different worshipers and challenging, threatening the different views of religion. I want to talk about George Whitefield a moment. Probably the most popular and the most powerful of the minister of the Great Awakening. He and his best friend were Ben Franklin. Now, Benjamin Franklin was very proud of sort of, he had his own quiet religion, but he was very skeptical of all religion. But you know how, like, religious people sometimes say religion's really good for you and good for other people, they should all be with? Well, Ben Franklin said, I may not believe, but it's really great when other people do, because then they behave so much better. So one of the things that I noticed in my history is that there were religious people, the theme of today's lecture, who want government to have little to do with religion, and then there were non-religious people who thought religion would be really good medicine and make people better behaved. So when Whitefield begins to anger local ministers because he's more popular, they bar him from using their churches. So Benjamin Franklin and Whitefield build a place in Philadelphia for Whitefield to preach. But, and here's the beginning of a sense of something special. They built a structure without any religious symbols. Here's what Franklin writes. The design is to not accommodate any particular sect, but inhabitants in general, so that even if the Mufti of Constantinople sends a missionary to preach Mohammedanism, he would find a pulpit at his service. And there's so many interesting things about Franklin's awareness of this. But most to me, first of all, that they're aware of a range of religions, but they're not threatened by them. They're welcoming them. They're getting a sense that if religion is good, then religion is good. And you don't go pick and attack and favor one religion or another. The Great Awakening also led to sort of different sort of denomination and sects being created, and each new one challenged the government, challenged the status quo. And the so-called New Light Baptists tremendously threatened both all the powers that be. And so in Massachusetts, there are these taxes set up to favor the dominant religion, and the Baptists said, we don't want to pay, and these complicated schemes were set up, complicated, to get an exemption, which the Baptists considered insulting. It wasn't the government's job to make me prove I shouldn't have to pay taxes. And the system was rigged so that generally you had people losing their farms over not paying taxes. Tremendous hostility. It was worse in Virginia. In Virginia, they're being jailed. Baptist ministers are being jailed for preaching without a license. Of course, they never could get a license. One moment in this Virginia struggle is particularly noteworthy, because a young 22-year-old named James Madison is walking down, sees the prison, sees the jail, sees the ministers, they're preaching, and he says, there is something so fundamentally wrong with someone being arrested for their belief. He writes this pained letter to a friend of his from Pennsylvania, a colony then that is not criminalizing people for their religious beliefs. And he says, this vexes me worst of anything whatever. I have squabbled, scolded, abused, and ridiculed to little purpose. I must beg of you to pity me and pray for liberty of conscience for all. At age 22, James Madison, who became the author of the First Amendment, saw something. He had an understanding. He saw the cruelty of punishing people for liberty of conscience. We now call that freedom of religion. I'd like to go back to liberty of conscience, because it explains much better what the framers understood. Conscience is yours. It's personal. And no government can tell you what you can or should believe. Now, what's interesting to me about the study of this period of time is how hard it was for people to see what the Baptist Joint Committee sees and said so frequently, that it's not just religious freedom for me, it's for everyone. So there were a lot of people who saw the circle and they were excluded, and they wanted the circle broadened so they were included. And they didn't mind so much. They didn't mind so much that others were still excluded. So they're beginning to voice and understand freedom of religion, but to have the courage to say there should be no circle blocking anyone out took a while. So let me give you one of the earlier steps. Isaac Backus is the leading battler in Massachusetts for the Baptists, trying to end the taxation. But his problem is, at least in historical terms, is that what he wanted was to say, hey, you know what? Baptists are just like other Protestants. Include us in. Now, he tried. He knew that taxation was wrong for religion. He knew that bothered him. And in a very strange meeting at the First Continental Congress, Backus comes down to where they're meeting in Philadelphia, brings down some Quaker friends, and they confront John Adams and say, you know, our state of liberty is forcing people to pay taxes for a religion they don't believe in. John Adams, who's a very interesting person because he struggles with this, he defends the state tax, the colonial taxation that favors the Puritan Congregationalists, and harms other religions. He says, liberty of conscience means we should have religious taxations. We should, quote, indulge the tender conscience of the people of Massachusetts and allow the majority to preserve their law. Indulge the tender conscience of the people of Massachusetts. Backus tribe could not get Adams or the rest of Massachusetts to change. So you begin to see that when the revolution is just beginning, America as a concept hasn't figured out how to include people universally in religious freedom. One of the things I discovered in my book was, I mean, Baptists, Quakers, they're disliked. No group was hated more than Catholics. Let me just read you something that the First Continental Congress wrote with a letter to the people of England complaining about the Catholics in Quebec. And I don't know about you, but I don't know any history book I ever read that says, hey, you know what those great guys like John Hancock are doing? They're writing language like this. They're saying that they're worried that the Catholics are going to reduce free Protestant colonies, that would be the United States, to slavery. And they're saying, don't you know about Catholics? It's a religion that has deluged England in blood and dispersed impiety, bigotry, persecution, and murder throughout the world. This is the First Continental Congress. These are the good guys. And it was right up to the beginning of the Revolutionary War where you had this. And one of the things that I'm reading in my book is I know that didn't prevail. And so I'm trying to figure out what happened. And one of the things that happened is George Washington. I don't know how much you know about the American colonies, but when they formed the United States of America, It was a plural. It was like the United Nations or the EU. It was each state had their own identity. The only person who thought of us as a nation was the only person charged with dealing with all 13 states, and that's George Washington, head of the military. So he's trying to deal with, because you see Quebec is Catholic, so they're trying to get Canada to join us in the revolution. He sends Benedict Arnold, then a good guy, he sends Benedict Arnold up to Canada, and he says, don't insult their religion. But he says something else. It's not just a tactic. Washington says, while we are contending for our own liberty, we should be very cautious of violating the rights of conscience in others. There's a magic moment throughout this period where great thinkers saw us and them as one. It's like, we're fighting for freedom. Hey, so are they. It's the same battle. It's a different religion. It's the same battle. In Virginia, in 1776, they're writing a new constitution now that we're free from England. And so the first great American statement on religious freedom in terms of government of this period of time. There had been other things by Roger Williams or William Penn. Both of them receded very hard to maintain a majority in favor of religious freedom. Virginia, though, really, because of Washington and Jefferson and Madison and George Mason, is able to create something that really does last. I'm going to tell you a key moment and a linguistic moment as well. Virginia Constitution, 1776, the draft says that religion or the duty of our Creator can only be directed by reason. All men should enjoy the fullest toleration in the exercise of religion. All men should enjoy the fullest toleration in the exercise of religion. 25-year-old James Madison, he's very shy, so he's afraid to speak. So he asks Patrick Henry, who's not afraid to speak, to put forth an amendment. And I call it the most important editorial change in the history of the freedom of religion. Instead of the fullest toleration of religion, Madison changed it to all men are equally entitled to the free exercise of religion. See, toleration, if you think about what you tolerate, it kind of implies you don't have to. It's a matter of your grace. You're such a decent person, you will tolerate those others. Madison saying, oh no, this is a fundamental right. George Washington, a far better student than people think, learned this lesson. And in a famous letter, he writes, it is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it was the indulgence of one class of people that another could enjoy the exercise of their inherent natural gifts. None of the framers after this point ever talked about tolerating minority religions. That implied it was a choice. Instead, they saw the uniformity, the combination, that everyone had this natural right. Massachusetts, remember, is still stuck in, if you will, a sort of Puritan mindset. When they write their constitution, they say, first of all, only Protestants can hold elective office. They also say that taxes must be collected by majority vote for religion. Do the math. So only the majority church, the most popular church, is going to get funding, and the others will not. So Bacchus continues to complain, says this is still violating our religious freedom. But what's interesting about Bacchus, and he's a person of his time, is that he didn't mind other parts of the Constitution that limited freedom of religion to every denomination of Christians. He was unable to rise above and fully universalize his vision and his experience. So, we're now, a few years later, we're 1783. We win the war, hooray for us. Here's where we are, though. The states are controlling their own destinies. That's what the whole plan of the Articles of Confederation. Six of these states bar both Jews and Catholics from serving in office. Two more merely Jews. One says you have to believe in God. There is general freedom to pray as you will. You're limited in government. And many of the states, mostly in New England, still have government-funded churches. So we're after the Revolution, we're 1783. Constitution's going to be written by the end of the decade, First Amendment shortly thereafter, and something happens in the middle. I call it the Second American Revolution. Virginia is having problems because the Anglican Church, which is no longer receiving tax money, is falling on hard times. They've gone from 95 parishes down to 38. They don't have money because no one of their parishioners is going to pay for them, so they want the government to pay. They've changed their name to the Episcopal Church, and they team up with Patrick Henry, governor, or soon to be governor, in order to get a tax to support Christian teachers. And this battle over the so-called assessment in Virginia becomes the defining moment, and I'll tell you why. James Madison is leading the battle against Patrick Henry. He's grown up a bit, James. And they're arguing over this tax to support Christian religion. Thomas Jefferson's in France, and he's writing these ferocious letters as they come up with a plan to stop this bill. Thomas Jefferson's plan is, quote, to devoutly pray for Henry's death. Not a bad plan, but Madison finds he needs another one. So what Madison does is, first of all, he gets Henry elected to be governor of Virginia, leading the legislature. And so he can't actually do the fight on the floor. And then Madison says, this is too important for the legislature to decide. Let's leave it to the people. He gets a delay of about 7 or 8 months. They have a circular drawn up with the bill. And they say, let's send it out to the people of Virginia and let's all debate it. So what we know about the bill now is basically from this circular that was sent. And basically the bill said taxpayers could select whichever society of Christians they wanted their tax money to go to. If you were not Christian, your money would go to a quote-unquote seminary of learning. That was the tax plan. It was trying actually to be more progressive than the old tax in Massachusetts that's still around that went to one favorite church. Here, any Christian denomination could get money. Everyone else, the money would go to some seminary of learning. As the lobbying is going on, people ask James Madison if he will write something. James Madison's an extraordinary lawyer as well as political theorist. And he writes something called the Memorial and Remonstrance. If you haven't read it, you should. It is one of the leading documents relied on by the Supreme Court to describe the American theory of freedom of religion. A memorial remonstrance is really nothing more than a petition, and people sign it, but it's an explanation of the reason. And Madison, and it's all done anonymously, no one knows who's writing it. We now know he wrote it. And among the lines he writes is, religion is wholly exempt from the cognizance of civil society. He says, before any man is a member of civil society, he must be considered as the subject of the governor of the universe. He then says something else that people, it's very interesting if you read how lawyers read this, they sort of ignore all the religious parts. It's very strange. Here's part that lawyers ignore, but I refuse to. He wrote, while we assert for ourselves a freedom to profess our religion that we believe to be divine origin, we cannot deny an equal freedom to those whose mind have not yet yielded to the evidence which convinced us. And he said, wait, you mean not yet? You mean you expect it to? And it's sort of interesting, this sort of moment. And I don't know whether Madison believes this, or he's talking to his audience, but there's a lot of religion in this as he's discussing the need to solely separate religion from government and to have the individual mind set free to explore. George Mason, who's sort of quarterbacking this political battle, sends this memorial remonstrance that's being signed by other people to George Washington. George Washington has a fascinating response. Two paragraphs. And then the last one he said, I can't write anymore after Martha's calling me for dinner, which I always think is sort of cool. So paragraph one, he says, you know, I really believe in religious freedom, but I must confess that I'm not much alarmed at the thought of making people pay for the support of religions they profess if denominations of other Christians or those who declare themselves Jews, Mohammedans, or otherwise may obtain proper relief. So he's saying, you know, it's not really bad to me to force people to pay for their own religion, but let's make sure that every conceivable religion is protected. But then, in the next paragraph, he says something that is incredibly important. He says, as the matter now stands, I wish the bill had never been proposed and would die an easy death. Why does he oppose this law that doesn't bother him in theory? It's because given the strong opposition of a respectable minority, passage of the bill would rankle and perhaps convulse the state. It will lead to societal unrest when government and religion get combined. So you have what I like to call Jefferson and Madison's largely philosophical, the mind is free approach, the very political and pragmatic Washington approach for keeping government away from religion. But then, as I started reading and doing the history, I found there was a third strand of religious, theological opposition to the connection of government and religion. Led by the way, Virginia Baptists, the basic theory in their petitions was the Church of Christ is not of this world. Therefore, how can sheriffs, county courts, public treasuries be employed for the purpose of supporting teachers of the Christian religion? It is contrary, they wrote, to the spirit of the gospel. Certainly, they wrote, the blessed author of our religion supported and maintained his gospel for hundreds of years without the aid of civil power. So you have a religious, theological view. And then I found out something fascinating. From my academic perspective, as the lawyer and the law professor, the Memorial and Remonstrance is sort of the Hall of Fame. It's the top. What I found out researching my book is that about 1,500 people signed Madison's petition, while 5,000 signed the Baptist petition. And no one knows. It's so strange to me that this religious perspective was politically more important. Shh, don't scare the children. So it messes with the narrative if you acknowledge that this religious argument prevailed and was understood as part of the discussion on why you should have freedom of religion. So let's move over, because now the bill is defeated. Henry's bill is defeated. Thomas Jefferson's bill for religious freedom is passed in its stead. And suddenly, in the next year, you have the Constitutional Convention, 1787. Constitutional Convention is very interesting because there's not a whole lot of religion in the Constitution. You have Article 6, which says no one can be required to take a religious oath. You have, you know, scattered things here and there, but religion is largely kept out of this document. But so is the Bill of Rights. When the Constitution is sent to the individual states for ratification, there is no specific protection for individual freedom, and more importantly, no guarantee that this new government would ever not be allowed to establish a religion. So we've seen states establish a religion, and the concern was this new national government, this new Constitution, supported by Washington and Franklin and Madison. There was no specific limitation on national governments endorsing establishing religion. So in Virginia, as in every state, there's a ratifying convention, and James Madison is coming down to fight for the Constitution. And he's being told, you know, you have to run for office. It's like a special one-shot deal. You run to be in the ratifying convention. And there's opposition to him. He's in fact losing. If there were any public polls, they would have shown him losing. And that opposition was being fueled by the Baptists, who were afraid in Virginia of the fact of a national government, a national church. And led by John Leland, they are lobbying against Madison being allowed to ratify the Constitution, against Virginia ratifying, because there is no Bill of Rights. Let me take a moment talking about John Leland, because as I'm researching the book, he became one of my heroes, a deeply, deeply pious man who had a vision that was extraordinarily inclusive. He said, when government was rightly formed, it embraces pagans, Jews, Mohammedans, and Christians within its fostering arms and impartially protects all of them. Do you remember that time John Adams goes after Bacchus and says, oh, we should have this tax, or, you know, let's protect the tender consciences of the majority of citizens? John Leland writes the following. Had a Jew and a Turk been in that same convention and made the same plea on tender conscience, the first for all to abstain from hog's flesh and the last to abstain from wine, would the gentleman, John Adams, have been so careful of hurting their soft feelings of the son of Isaac and the son of Ishmael that he would have abstained from pork and wine for all his days? The vision that he had of respect for other religions, he saw was the same struggle. He saw the uniformity. He said, I will never take a religious oath, even if it is one I agree with, because it is simply not the place. He said it would be idolatry to acknowledge a power that the head of the church, Jesus Christ, has never appointed. With a religious backing and a religion theology, he was saying it is simply not the place of government. It is not the place of government to tell people how to worship and what to believe. One of my favorite images he had, and again, this is a very deeply religious man. He said when he saw people working on the Sabbath, he was sad. His heart would cry out to them. But he said, when he sees the sheriff arresting them for working on the Sabbath, he gets angry. He said, the Sunday Sabbath loses its Christian character and becomes a tyrant over conscience. So this is the voice, if you will, and it's a powerful, articulate voice for both a religious belief and a view of the limited role of government. James Madison veers off in his path home, meets with Leland. There's all these fables about where and how they met, but there seems little doubt that Madison assures Leland that he will never do anything that will not protect religious freedom. Constitution is ratified, Madison runs for Congress, and all the people saying, oh, this is the guy who didn't want to amend the Constitution. So James Madison makes what is known as the most important campaign promise ever, and not just because it was kept. The most important campaign promise he makes to his Baptist minister named George Eve, and he says, I promise that in the very first Congress, we will design and send to the states for ratification provisions to protect the right of conscience. Led by Eve and Leland, Madison wins election to Congress and does indeed manage to create the Bill of Rights. First Amendment, beginning with the language that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And this, again, this is not, I mean, Madison believes in this, but this is only happening because of the wide, strong support of a very strong religious community. So let me just give you a couple more moments, and then I want to take questions. Because the new nation has to sort of deal with religion and basically fulfill this vision. And so, Thomas Jefferson's very famous letter about a wall of separation between church and state is almost a plant. It's a softball question from Baptists in Connecticut who are fighting against that New England taxation favoring majority religion. That's what led Jefferson. The question wasn't so much what can Jefferson do, but is there an American theory of freedom of religion that the individual states should follow? Now, starting in the mid-20th century, if you will, the states are bound by the Constitution in the same way. They are bound by the First Amendment. But at the time of the 1800s, they weren't. So the Massachusetts Baptists were trying, Connecticut Baptists were trying to get Jefferson to say, look, this is what Americans believe, that church and state must be separate. But you want to be careful about that word separate, because they didn't really mean you can't talk about religion in public. And in fact, I sort of like this. 2 days after that famous wall of separation between church and state, John Leland shows up in Washington with the mammoth cheese. You know about the mammoth cheese? It is 1,235 pounds. Leland wanted to do this to celebrate the pure, both the economics of New England and the purity of Thomas Jefferson. It is the first time the word mammoth is used as an adjective. The mammoth cheese, it goes for about 3 weeks. It begins to rot, but we're not going to talk about that. And Leland declares the reason for this cheese is to show the town believed that the supreme ruler of the universe, who raises up men to achieve great events, has raised up a Jefferson at this critical day to defend republicanism. So what I like to say is they may have wanted a separation of church and state, but they didn't mind combining church and politics. And later on, Madison becomes president. I want to sort of, a couple of things I just want to end with. Madison vetoes a bill. It's actually sort of this interesting little story. In the sort of Western territories that are owned by the national government, this Baptist church builds a little house, and it's accidentally on federal land. So they petition Congress, could you just give us this land, this couple of acres, please, because we have this house here. And Congress says, sure, why not? James Madison vetoes the bill and says, no, you don't give federal stuff to religious organizations for the use of religious societies. And one of my favorite moments in this story is that the two Baptist churches in North Carolina write to Madison and commend him because the law was not consistent with the spiritual interest of religion. They wrote, when government and religion are combined, religious societies are given an undue weight and corrupt influence in public affairs. And as Madison wrote, it was remarkable that they were arguing against their own self-interest, or more precisely, their short-term self-interest. Because they knew in the long term, that's where freedom was. So I want to end with one last thought, which is the concept of a Christian nation. Certainly, when I said during the colonial time, there was never a Christian nation if you include Catholics as Christians because they kept narrowing the definition. But even afterwards, Washington, Jefferson, Madison never used that phrase. See, Christian nation demographically means majority. Who could dispute it? But it's like calling it a white nation. It kind of implies that not everyone is really the same level of citizen. And so the question was, did the framers at this period of time between the First Amendment being written and the end of the Madison era ever consider themselves to be a Christian nation? And the framers, the politicians, never used that phrase. And I want to give you two religious people and just sort of talk about their vision of this. One is John Carroll, who's a Catholic priest who had gone with Benjamin Franklin up to Canada to try to convince Quebec to join us. Actually, it's a really cool story. They go up, Carroll and Franklin, and they get rejected. You know, Canada didn't support us in the war. But Carroll and Franklin become friends. Franklin later writes in his diary, you know what's really cool, he writes? The Pope agreed with my suggestion, and he's going to make John Carroll bishop. And I'm thinking, in a time when everyone's hating the Catholics, Ben Franklin's hanging out with the Pope and saying, here's a good guy for you, and the Pope's agreeing. So that's Franklin is sort of another of my heroes here. Anyway, John Carroll is upset because someone writes right after the Constitution is implemented that non-Protestants should be barred from office. John Carroll doesn't say, hey, you know what? We're Christian too. He says it's not about religion. The establishment of the American empire was not the work of this or that religion, but arose from a general exertion from all her citizens. So I'm in the religious minority. I'm not trying to get into this religious club. I want all citizens included. John Leland argued vigorously that America was not a Christian nation. He said, in fact, if all the souls of the government were saints of God and they were formed into society by law, that society could not be a gospel church, but be a mere creature of state. He warned of the, quote, shocking monster of a Christian nation if the Congress established any or all Christian religion. The glory of America will depart, The blood and treasure expended in our revolution will all be lost. And one of the things he said would be lost was the asylum for the distressed would be turned into a prison and an inquisition. There was a vision that people had during the framing. And there's a debate. Obviously, some people wanted to use religion, use government for their own religion. But the ones who prevailed, the ones who educated, the ones who defined the American experience were the ones who understood that both their religion and their religious freedom depended on full liberty of conscience and the government not rooting for, not helping, not manipulating, not controlling the religion of the individuals. That's the legacy that we got from them. Thank you very much.
That was Michael Meyerson, delivering his first presentation for the 2014 Walter B. and K.W. Sheridan Lectures on Religious Liberty and Separation of Church and State. His second presentation, delivered at Baylor Law School in Waco, Texas, is also available as a podcast. For more information on the Sheridan Lectures, visit our website at bjconline.org/lectures.